weeknights from 6 on 2FM.
Thanks to the two Johnnies for driving it through the afternoon. It's Tuesday, the 31st of May, and this is Game On. Coming up today, Nadal versus Djokovic or Roland Garros. It doesn't get much bigger than that. Conor Nyland is standing by to preview tonight's match.
My last match against him was, I think, last year here. So I didn't play this kind of matches for the last 3 months. So it's going to be a big challenge for me. He already won, I think, last 9 matches in a row, winning in Rome and now winning here in straight sets every match. Probably he will be confident.
In football, Mark Langdon's with us to talk transfer mumblings, World Cup playoffs and the Nations League as the boys in green weigh up the security risks of playing in Armenia.
You know, there's a security delegation gone over in advance, so they will brief us, I'm sure, you know, between now and then. They're going on the ground, so certainly they will brief us in due course.
Plus, in cricket, we catch up with stand-in Irish cricket captain Gabby Lewis, and in racing, I look forward to the big weekend at Epsom, and we might look back at Leicester Piggott as well. If you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
GameOn2FM.
Yes, a very good evening to you, John Kenny, and Ruby here for the next hour. Evening, Ruby.
How are you, JK?
Can't complain at all. What about the Longfellow, Leicester, passing from this mortal coil? That's obviously, it's a big shock, I suppose, for the racing world, but he really was in the vanguard of the jockey, wasn't he?
Oh, he was just an iconic figure of the sport, John. I mean, when you look at his career from the 50s all the way to when he eventually stopped in the 90s, it was an incredible life, an incredible career. I feel a bit of a fraud even talking about him, because most of what he achieved, John, was achieved before I was even born. I remember him on his comeback tour after being to prison when he went and won the Breeders' Cup and Royal Academy and his final British Classic on Rodrigo de Triana, which was his 30th in total. But he was just, I don't know, I suppose at that time it was before sport realised that it needed to spread out to get big. Racing had a much bigger audience. I mean, the Derby was running on Epsom on a Wednesday, and Leicester Piggott was just iconic. And to do what he did, to win nine derbies. I mean, and there was no set pattern to it.
No.
He didn't ride them all the same way. He rode them so differently. He was just had such a feeling to it. And like he was such a huge name. When you hear the stories and you look back, I mean, he was as big in Britain in the 60s, 70s, 80s as soccer players are now. I mean, it was just incredible.
I actually saw him race at Leopardstown. He came over here occasionally, obviously raced in the Irish Derby, but this was just like an evening meeting or something. I saw him as a kid, and everybody was in awe of him.
They were, and yeah, I listened to people that obviously rode with him or he rode for or knew of him, and they almost all have the same fear, yet a respectful fear of Leicester Piggott, and that's the way he was. He had that, how did Kieran Fallon describe him? He was almost like the mafia in the weigh room. You didn't speak to him. Like, he just laid down the law, but in a respectful kind of way. Like, I suppose, remember him a little bit. I remember being in the Phoenix Park in 85 with my grandfather when he won on Comanche Run. Now, I had no idea what he had just achieved. He was winning the Champion Stakes. But he was just... and I think to watch him in 92 on Royal Academy winning the Breeders' Cup, I think that was the only glimpse I got of what or who Leicester Piggott was. But there's never a good time for anybody to die, John. But I think if you're Leicester Piggott to pass the week of the Epsom Derby, it's, I think, maybe fitting. I mean, that's where he was, kingpin. Nine derbies, it's unprecedented. And the derby this year will be run in his honour, and I think that is fitting.
Okay, we'll talk more about Leicester and obviously the Epsom Derby week a little later on in the programme. But we're going to start with tennis. Rafa Nadal's rivalry with Novak Djokovic, probably the biggest in the history of men's tennis. They have met a record 58 times. Djokovic is leading the head-to-head by 30 matches to 28 matches. But they're playing Roland Garros on the dirt, and it is Nadal who's actually got the better record, winning 7 and losing 2. And former pro Conor Nyland joins us. Good evening to you, Conor.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Very good. What are you expecting this evening then when they meet head-to-head? Are these two players in the twilight of their career? I mean, their combined age is over 70.
Yeah, I mean, we've been saying that for a few years, but obviously Nadal won Aussie, and as Nadal said in the intro there, Djokovic has won Rome. The warm-up event is playing, I think, the best out of anybody right now. I think Nadal apparently requested a daytime start for this match, but I think with the interest in it, certainly in France and obviously around the world, they've gone for a night session, I guess, to capture more of the primetime TV audience, which plays into Djokovic's hands a little bit because it's going to be colder and damper, which means that Nadal's kind of biggest strength, which is his topspin forehand and how that reacts off the clay, is going to be dampened with the colder air and the way the ball kind of won't jump as much off the surface. So it's going to be in Djokovic's strike zone that little bit more, and it's going to come down to such fine margins. I think that might be prove just that little bit of an advantage to Djokovic tonight. Plus, Nadal's coming off the back of a tough five-setter in his round of 16 against Felix Auger-Aliassime's team. So while I wouldn't usually be going up, betting against Nadal and clay at Roland Garros, for whatever reason tonight, I think Djokovic just shades it.
Conor, I've just been watching Roland Garros in the background here behind me, and obviously Alcaraz and Zverev are playing right now, but what I did notice them was them watering the court. I don't recall watching them watering the court in the past. Is that to try and harden the clay to keep it quick as it gets cooler in the evening?
Yeah, it compacts the clay. Most matches you'll see them watering the court after a set. Sometimes they do it more frequently if it's hotter. It's reasonably sunny over there today, so I guess they're just trying to keep it. It can get quite slippy if they're not watering it. So yeah, that's what they're doing there tonight. But obviously, naturally, when the sun goes down in Paris tonight, it's going to get a little bit colder and damper. And we haven't had night sessions at Roland Garros up until a couple of years ago when they put in the new roof. They got floodlights. So now we've got the chance to see these guys playing into the evening like we do at the other slams in Australia and New York. So, yeah, it'll be a late start for them. I think it's a not before 7:45 Irish time, not before 8:45 French time. So the lads will be playing past midnight tonight.
Yeah, and we know that they pat down the clay and they also clean the lines as well, so to make sure that the marshal around the side can actually see if it's in or out or not. Anyway, let's hear what Nadal has to say about tonight's game.
Well, I don't know 100% because I don't have a close test against him, because my last match against him was, I think, last year here. So I didn't play this kind of matches for the last 3 months, so it's going to be a big challenge for me. He already won, I think, the last 9 matches in a row, winning in Rome and now winning here in straight sets every match. Probably he will be confident. I know how is my situation, and I accept it well, and I'm going to fight for it. No, that's it. No, I... just enjoying the fact that I am here for one more year, and being honest, every match that I play here, I don't know if it's going to be my last match here in Roland Garros in my tennis career, you know.
Rafa Nadal on that Djokovic match tonight. Nadal, Conor, has had injury problems in the past, in the recent past, we know that too. And Djokovic hasn't played that much in terms of Grand Slam tournaments because obviously he was chucked out of Australia. So where are they, do you think, ahead of tonight's game?
Well, Nadal's obviously inched ahead of him in the Slams. Tally's at 21, Djokovic is at 20. Djokovic probably have a bit of a chip on his shoulder after what happened to him down in Australia, not being allowed to play. So he's going to be really, really up for it. He didn't play a lot, as you said, at the start of the year because of that Australia incident, but he hasn't been injured, so he was able to train. And he's had a really good clay court run where he got to play. He played Belgrade, I think, which he won. He played a good tournament in Madrid. He played a great match and lost to Alcaraz. And then I feel like he was kind of peaking at the right time in Rome where he won it playing great tennis. Whereas with Nadal, he lost a match again. He also lost to Alcaraz at Madrid, but wasn't physically right. And then he pretty much hobbled off the court in Rome a couple of weeks ago. And like, if you looked at Nadal's clay court record 5-6 years ago, he would have turned up at Monte Carlo in late April and pretty much swept that, then Barcelona and Madrid. And he was pretty much untouchable in the lead up. The last couple of years, he's had to manage his schedule and just try to get over the line at Roland Garros. which he's been able to do over the last couple of years. But yeah, he's just starting to look like he's maybe losing his edge a little bit at Roland Garros. I feel like he still goes up 10-20% when he's there, but like he's a lot better than he was here, than he was at Rome and Madrid. But I just think if this was a final, I'd be saying maybe he could pull it out. But I just think a quarter final against Djokovic with his run, he's been playing great, hasn't lost a set. Yeah, I just feel like he's just that fraction sharper at the moment, Djokovic.
The crowd haven't been reacting great to Djokovic, though. They booed him onto court yesterday, and they could rally behind Nadal. Could that play a part in it?
Yeah, I mean, it'll be competitive, don't get me wrong, and I think if Nadal can get his teeth into this and the crowd get into it, and I think the atmosphere will be great tonight. Of course, I think he could potentially pull out a result, but yeah, look, the crowd only have so much influence, so I just feel like he's up against it tonight, but absolutely, potentially he could create a bit of atmosphere and get a bit of momentum and do something.
Yeah, but one thing about Djokovic is he feeds into that, doesn't he?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was at Wimbledon one year, I think the whole crowd against, it was the final he beat, when he beat Federer in that epic five-setter 3 years ago, 4 years ago, it was 2018. The whole crowd was so pro-Federer. And he just said at the end of the match that when he heard the crowd chanting Federer, Federer, he just said he heard Djokovic in his head. this guy has, he's pulled himself out of a lot of tough situations. I don't think it'll faze him. It just might give Nadal that extra couple of percent that he needs at the moment. I don't think Djokovic is going to be affected by the crowd, but it just might give Nadal a little bit of a push. But again, I'd be surprised if it could be the difference tonight.
Yeah, and that's one thing about professional players. Doesn't matter. I'm talking about individual sports here. They're in at 2% basically of the whole population of the entire playing population of individual sports that are complete and absolute winners. They just do not like to lose. And Djokovic, Nadal would be in that bracket as well. Crowd or no crowd?
Yeah, I mean, look, Djokovic left Belgrade at 12 and went to a tennis academy in Germany, left his family and has been doing this for 25, 30 years. And I think he's probably used to not being a favourite now. I feel like 10 years ago or so, I think he was surprised when crowds were sort of against him. But I feel like he probably knows now when he goes out, if he's playing one of the Federer and Nadal, that trilogy, that the crowd tend to favour the other guys. I don't think there's going to be any surprises on that front for him either. So, you know, I think he'll be able to manage that if it does happen.
The winner obviously will face Alcaraz or Zverev, who are playing right now in Roland Garros. But, Conor, do you just say the draw is completely falling apart? Medvedev is out, Tsitsipas out. I mean, the highest ranked player left in on the other side of the draw is Casper Ruud, Andrei Rublev at the seventh seed. It has to be divided by seeds, but the lower side of the draw is not shaping up like the top side.
That half of the draw was sort of, well, we were saying wide open for Tsitsipas, who was in the final up 2 sets to love last year against Djokovic, and he was taken out by Rune, a young Danish guy, 19 years old. So you have Alcaraz, Zverev, Nadal and Djokovic all bunched up together, and then you've got this opening at the bottom. Like, Rune is a really talented player. Ruud from Norway is a great clay courter. That's going to be a pretty interesting one. Cilic, I suppose, he's got a pretty good draw on that. Medvedev, number 2 seed, is great on grass, great on a hard court, a little bit not quite as good on a grass court, and it's pretty poor on a clay court just movement wise for whatever reason. He just doesn't seem comfortable. So Cilic beat him last night, so yeah, it'll be interesting to see who comes through. I wouldn't be surprised if it's Casper Ruud, a bit of a surprise potentially for him to be in a Grand Slam final, but just with the way the draw is shaped up, he could potentially be on the final on Sunday.
Yeah, that's the vagaries of clay court tennis, though, isn't it? You could find on grass and hard court, it's the, you know, the usual get to the top. It's kind of predictable, but it's very, very unpredictable on clay, isn't it?
Yeah, with clay, with the movement of it and the way you have to slide into the ball, unless you've grown up on it, it's really hard to master the timing. And you see the way Alcaraz, having grown up in Spain and on clay, can use the drop shot plus play the sort of more traditional know, power, looking for the forehand type game style. He's able to mix it up, plus his movement just looks so natural on clay, whereas a Medvedev would have grown up in Russia on either indoor hard, and he would have played some clay in the summer months, but would have mostly been on hard courts. He just never quite gotten to grips with it. So yeah, you definitely see that little bit of a, especially, and that's why Nadal has been able to dominate on clay in a way that maybe nobody else has on any other surface. So yeah, it'll be good. But Rune and Alcaraz are two genuine, exciting talents. Alcaraz has put out as good as I've ever seen, I would say, as an 18, 19-year-old. I think he's going to be a true great of the game, and it's been amazing to watch him. I see he's down, obviously, against Zverev at the moment, which is a little bit surprising, but what he's put together over the last few weeks on clay, he just turned 19 at Madrid like 3 weeks ago. He is an absolute phenomenal talent.
Okay, before we let you go, Conor, we did start talking about Nadal versus Djokovic. You're leaning slightly towards Djokovic, are you?
I am, yeah. I'm going against Nadal on clay at Roland Garros, which is probably...
That's tempting fate, that one, all right.
...thing I've ever said. But, yeah, look, if you just look at the last couple of days, and look, we're not talking about anybody here. This is Djokovic, who's won 20 slams and beaten Nadal a couple of times at Roland Garros. So, yeah, I just think he has the slight edge tonight. But, yeah, can't wait to watch it.
Oh, yeah, it could be a heck of a game, all right. Thanks for joining us. That's Conor Nylan there on Nadal and Djokovic. I think it's about 7:45 our time that match is on tonight.
Oh, it could be a bit later, JK, because this other game is dragging on here. And Alcaraz, the 19-year-old that Conor was on about, is fighting back in the background here behind me.
Okay, well, that's what it's scheduled for, but you're right, these things could change. All right, let's take a break. We're going to talk football next.
RTE 2FM. On 2FM with Green Farm. B vitamins equal big benefits. The new Green Farm added benefits range is packed with essential B vitamins. Available in store now. Game on.
European football.
Welcome back to Game on this chilly end to May, and we're about to talk European football, and thankfully joining us on the line is our usual correspondent, the Racing Post, Mark Langdon. Mark, I think the headline that caught me over the last couple of days was Robert Lewandowski saying that his time at Bayern is over and the Polish striker wants to move. Where is he going to go?
Yeah, that's right. He was issued, I suppose, a come and get me plea, really, to Barcelona. Is by far his preferred destination. Of course, you know, somebody that has broken goal scoring records in the Bundesliga for Bayern Munich, has been a regular source of goals both for them and before that Borussia Dortmund, Poland. You know, somebody that scores a lot of goals for them, and also, you know, the captain of the team and sort of the real leader of their team. He was on international duty when he came out with those comments, and obviously I think it's a lot easier for players to do that when they are with their international team rather than on sort of club duties. He's kind of forcing the issue now. There are two problems. One, Barcelona have got sort of the constraint, not necessarily that they haven't got any money now, but fitting the deals they want to do within financial fair play. And the second issue is that Bayern Munich have said that they won't be selling Robert Lewandowski this summer, and they prefer to keep him for another year and then let his contract run out. So I think he's definitely one to watch over the summer. You know, he's not only spoken about wanting to go and play in Spain for, you know, just as an experience for him professionally, but also as a lifestyle. He says that he wants to just live in Spain and, you know, try something else. That hasn't gone down very well in Munich at the moment. So interesting to see whether his latest actions force Bayern Munich into selling him when they really don't want to.
Well, he has got another year of his contract to run, but and they're saying they're going to hang on to him until his contract run out. But if you want to leave, you're going to have to leave. I mean, there's no way they can force him to stay because he just won't play for them properly.
Yeah, I don't know that. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of these clubs now are, you know, they're talking about 30 million, between 30 to 40 million as a transfer fee. I mean, I think Bayern Munich will feel like that they can just swallow that because, you know, he's worth that to them for 1 year. He remember, of course, he joined on a free transfer, so it wasn't something that they had to sort of pay out a huge sum for him. And I think from Bayern's point of view, they would probably feel like that he's not going to write off a whole year. You know, as a professional, if he did go back, he would get his head down and play for Bayern Munich for that last year. I tend to think that, you know, that would be what Bayern would be saying at this stage, and they want to make sure that they get, you know, top price from him from Barcelona. And I think if it was to be around 30 or 40 million at Lewandowski's age, you maybe feel like that that's not a bad deal, really, for Bayern Munich to be doing. They've had Lewandowski's best years. It, to me, feels like a deal that probably would happen, but... you know, he's 33 now, soon to be 34 in August. So if you can get 30, 40 million and reinvest that, you feel like you probably would if you were Bayern Munich. But the way that Bayern Munich are run, you maybe wouldn't be saying that publicly at this stage. You know, you'd want to be maximising every sort of euro you can get out of Barcelona.
Mark, you used a phrase there a second ago, and we probably should have discussed this when we were talking about Kylian Mbappe last week or the week before. Financial fair play. Is that just a statement that's thrown around in soccer, or does it actually exist?
It definitely exists in La Liga, because La Liga have their own separate rules about how much you can spend, and that is linked to turnover, it is linked to transfers in and out, it is linked to wage bill. And, you know, I think Barcelona and Real Madrid are getting slightly frustrated, maybe, with La Liga, because obviously they're having to sort of do certain rules to fit into the domestic picture that don't appear to apply at sort of Europe's top table in terms of UEFA. But it definitely exists in La Liga. That, you know, it was one of the reasons Barcelona said they were unable to sign Messi to a new deal last summer. It was, you know, why they had so many issues trying to get rid of players and offer them around for free, because they wanted to sign their own. If you remember, Sergio Aguero took a long while for that transfer to actually go through. So it definitely exists in La Liga, and they've been really strict about, you know, the amount you can spend based on your turnover and based on your ins and outs and stuff like that. So, I mean, if La Liga can do it, then you feel like everywhere should, in theory, be able to. And Barcelona, as it stands, La Liga's president has come out this week and said, as it stands, you know, Barcelona would not be able to sign Lewandowski because he's just not in their kind of financial remit. It would mean they'd have to let somebody go. It's why somebody like Frenkie de Jong is being linked with Manchester United, because it would mean a tie-up with Erik ten Hag. It would free up funds for Barcelona to do some business. But yeah, financial fair play, I think a lot of clubs have lost faith in what that actually means at UEFA level, but at La Liga level, it's definitely in existence.
Tell us, as we move it on, Scotland-Ukraine, there's a lot of focus on that World Cup semi-final playoff match. Winner will face Wales on Sunday. We, Republic of Ireland, I'm talking about, a lot of emphasis on that because we're kicking off the Nations League against Armenia this coming weekend. So Scotland and Ukraine, obviously with the war in Ukraine as well, there's going to be a lot of focus on that game. How do you see that going?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really difficult one to call. I mean, I'd probably go for Scotland just because of the preparation for Ukraine, understandably, has not been ideal. The team's been sort of together in terms of those that are not playing in Europe's main leagues. They've been together for a while. They've been playing in Slovenia. They've played three or four friendlies against club teams, but it's not... You know, even when you're playing Borussia Mönchengladbach, it's not, you know, the Gladbach are going to be playing that game at full tilt. They've got a lot of emotion on their side, and, you know, you that can take you a long way, and I'm sure that they're going to leave nothing out there on the pitch. You know, they're playing for much more than a World Cup at the moment. But I think that it should benefit Scotland just in terms of that lack of preparation for Ukraine. I think that Scotland have been heading in the right direction for some time as well, really, under Steve Clarke. And at home, I think I'd fancy them to win the game, even in normal circumstances, actually. And just the way that it is for Ukraine at the moment probably just makes it that slightly bit sort of easier for Scotland to set up that clash against Wales for the spot at the World Cup. But I think everybody, sort of all the neutrals, will want Ukraine to win. I saw even Graham Souness saying that he wanted Ukraine to win, so that would be a weird situation for Scotland.
Scottish captain.
Yeah, exactly. But Yeah, I think if Scotland can deal with that, and that may be Steve Clarke's hardest job, just getting the players to really want it, you know, and to really want to win, because, like I say, everybody kind of, you know, would I think, like to see Ukraine there if you're a neutral. So that will not be the easiest job for Clarke. But I think if you look at that Scotland team, the results they've had over the last couple of years, the fact that they're at home, I think that that sort of does sort of make them reasonably strong favourites to progress through to play Wales.
I know there's more to life than sport, but can you really see 11 professionals almost playing the sympathy card in a soccer match and not going to a World Cup?
I can't see that. I just think that you know, that professionalism just kicks in, and you know, the 11 Scots wheeled on, you know, by a full house. You know, I feel like they'll be able to forget about it and just, you know, beat the team that's in front of them, and, you know, just do their jobs. I mean, you know, these elite professionals have to overcome a lot, you know, at times, and are just able to put it to the back of their mind and get on with the job at hand. It's one of the reasons why, you know, they've made it to the top in such a competitive sport as it is. I know there was some complaints as well from some Scotland fans not happy that Andy Robertson was, you know, celebrating with Liverpool on the, you know, the open top bus parade that they had on Sunday, rather than coming back and sort of setting up the training. But again, I still feel like, you know, he had a beer on the coach, and it probably wasn't a great look, but I'm sure he'll be, you know, as up for it as if they were playing anybody else. And I would feel like Scotland should be able to just put that to the back of their mind for 90 minutes.
Nah, the blow will do. I've done him the world of good, and he'll be feeling a bit guilty now, and he'll try extra hard for Scotland. I wouldn't be too worried about that.
I can't believe Suna said that, though.
John is not just having this, Mark. He just can't get over it. Kevin De Bruyne has come out as well in a different statement, and he's given out stink about the UEFA Nations League and has branded it unimportant.
Yeah, I mean, he basically said that there's no point in this competition, the Nations League, and he, you know, he'd rather be on his summer holidays rather than playing four matches now. I can understand why somebody right at the top would maybe feel that, and De Bruyne will know his own body and kind of the way that it's been pushed in the last couple of years, with the calendar has been more hectic than sort of ever before. But, you know, football is not just about the absolute elite. It's not just about what Kevin De Bruyne wants. And I think overall, the Nations League has been a success. What UEFA wanted to do was to get more competitive matches for teams playing against teams at sort of the right level. I think they've managed that. I think they've created a competition that's worth winning. I mean, France seemed to celebrate winning it last time around. And it also offers kind of some smaller nations this backdoor entry to a major tournament. And, you know, North Macedonia let nobody down when they qualified for the Euros, you know, via this route previously. And, you know, it does give sort of those kind of nations the opportunity, a second chance to get to a major tournament. And I think that overall it's been a success. I can get the feeling of them not wanting to play four games in 2 weeks that we're about to get into at the moment. But of course, that's a consequence, not more of the fact that we've got a Winter World Cup coming up, and the international dates have had to all be moved around. And that's probably not the Nations League fault that we've got that World Cup.
Yeah, and I guess there is a meaningless friendlies as well, doesn't it? Ireland are playing Armenia at the weekend. It's a 2 o'clock start. You can hear it on RT Radio 1 and also on TV. You can see it. There was one or two problems or questions asked about security in Yerevan. We do know that the Armenia-Azerbaijan border remains a real bone of contention over Nagorno-Karabakh. Occasional cross-border fighting in the past has led to military and civilian casualties as well. Actually, here's Stephen Kenny on a potential security risks in Armenia.
We've not been briefed on that at the moment, but I know that there's a delegation gone over in the early hours. Like, they're gone ahead of, you know, there's a security delegation gone over in advance, so they will brief us, I'm sure, you know, between now and then. They're gone on the ground, headed by Joe McGlew, the head of security. So certainly they I'm sure they will brief us in due course.
Well, the Armenia FA have actually told Irish, the FAI, that there's no worries, and I would tend to agree with them on that. What do you think, Mark?
Well, I think you have to sort of listen to your security team, don't you? And if they're saying that there's no issues and that things will be okay, then you have to go with that. It's been an uncomfortable situation, there's no doubt about that. But it's one of those where you employ people to make those kind of decisions for you, and if they give it the green light, then I think you go and play. And it sounds like that's definitely going to be the case. And I think from Ireland's point of view, they just want to carry on the kind of good positive vibes that have been coming. And the Nations League, when I was sort of speaking about that opportunity, what it offers countries, for somebody like Ireland, I think this is a winnable group. And you never know if you might need that in the future. So I think it's, well, not all countries are taking it seriously, and some nations will be sort of thinking more about the World Cup. I do think that this is a group that Ireland can really sort of attack and go at and potentially top the section, really.
Armenia lost 9-0 to Norway in the last match, so
they did. I think that Armenia have not always picked their strongest team, and Mkhitaryan, of course, retired from international football, by far their best player. So it's a good opportunity to make a winning start. And
let's hear about Mkhitaryan. I know he's announced his retirement from international football this year, but my colleague Raf Dalio has been on the RTÉ Soccer podcast. You can actually see that on the RTÉ Sports website. He's been speaking to the Armenian football journalist Robert Kasparian about the great Henrik Mkhitaryan.
Without Mkhitaryan, Armenia plays good. Like, without Mkhitaryan, Armenia plays good. Wow. Death thoughts, yeah. But and it was irresolvable, because I'm thinking, we are talking about the player, the best Armenian player ever, and someone can speak loudly that Henrik Mkhitaryan doesn't mean the Armenian national team. Are you okay? It is impossible.
It might be impossible, but I can't wait for Roy Keane to come out next week and say he hopes that the Ukraine beat Ireland, and that just pushes JK over the edge altogether.
Yeah, can't see him saying that. That would be a surprise, I think it's fair to say.
Absolutely. Before we leave you go, Perisic has gone to Spurs. That's a good transfer, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. He's one of Antonio Conte's big targets in the summer. Arrives on a free transfer, knows the Conte system, played for him at Inter, a very attack-minded left wing back now, will get through the miles that Conte wants, and will be able to play that football that Conte wants, because he wants the wing backs to be really high and to be a goal threat. And I don't think that they were in they didn't get enough goals last year, those Tottenham wing backs, and he'll want that to change over the course of the summer. And Perisic, I think, is a really clever signing for Tottenham.
Yeah, Ralph Diallo is his name, of course. Sorry, Ralph, apologies for that. Listen, Mark, thanks for joining us on the line. That's Mark Langdon there, talking European and indeed world football as well. And we're going to be talking to Gabby Lewis after this.
RTÉ 2FM. Game on 2FM with Green Farm. Green Farm's newest chicken and turkey range is full of B vitamins, which play a vital role in maintaining good health and well-being. Available in store now. Game on 2FM.
Ruby's watching the tennis. How's it going?
Yeah, John, you're right. There could be a 7:45. I was going to say throw in, but it won't be a throw in. But
throw up
even, yeah. With Novak Djokovic and Rafa Nadal could well be on court at 7:45, because Alexander Verev has just broken Carlos Alcaraz in the fourth set. He leads 2-1 and is now 5-4 in front and serving for the match.
All right, thanks very much for that. A 90-ball century to newly named interim Irish cricket captain. Gabby Lewis led the Scorchers to a comprehensive victory over second-place Dragons in the Arcas Super 50 Cup in Oak Hill in County Wicklow over the weekend. Fabulous spot for a game of cricket. Lewis, who was named interim Irish international captain with Laura Delaney still recovering from injury, dominated the match with the player of the match winning innings of 122 from 108 balls, an innings that featured 19 boundaries. 6 centuries have been scored in the history of the R-Class Super Series, and Gabby Lewis has got 2 of them. Gabby, good evening to you.
Evening, John. How are you?
I'm very good. This is nice and timely from your point of view ahead of the South African series. You've got three T20s coming up against them starting on Friday in Pembroke. So you're in good nick and looking forward to it, I'd say.
Yes, yes, looking forward to it a lot. We've had a good run-up to it with the Arcus Super 50 Cup, so looking forward to getting into the T20s now on Friday, so I'm really looking forward to it.
Laura's not there, injured as we know. You're missing several players as well through different causes, some in exams as well. So they've given you the captain's armband. How do you feel about that?
I'm really excited. I had some experience. I have some experience captaining the Scorchers, and I've captained a few teams growing up. So I'm really looking forward to getting going on Friday. It's a really exciting squad that we have. Obviously, relatively new, but I think it's a great challenge, and I am really, really looking forward to it.
I know at 21, Gabby, you're not exactly old, but you are one of the senior figures in this squad or team. Even, do you see the captaincy as added responsibility or just a challenge you're ready for?
Definitely a challenge that I'm ready for. Obviously, I think it is in my hope to do Captain Ireland in the future, going forward. But Laura's obviously doing a great job at the moment. I didn't think it would come this quick, but no, I am looking forward to the challenge on Friday. I'm really looking forward to the series getting started now.
Yeah, Ruby just asked there about the fact that you're 21, because a lot of the players that you have underneath you are very young. Like Amy Hunter, we know, is a tremendous batter, but you know, still a teenager. And there's a lot of the players around you are still teenagers as well, aren't they?
Yes, we've got a very youthful squad, which it's very exciting as well. I think they bring a lot of freedom. Obviously, they kind of think less about the game, which is sometimes better in a way. You kind of let them play more freely. And yeah, they just bring obviously a very youthful approach to it, which is great. We do have a mixture of ages, but I think we gel very nicely as a squad, and we're getting along great. I think we have a great team culture, which has been built over the last few years. So yeah, it's obviously great having that youthful side to the team as well.
The selectors have chosen four possible debutants as well. Obviously, Arlene, Kelly, Alana, Dalzell, Sarah Forbes and Kate McAvoy. What are you expecting from them? You're the captain. Go on.
it's very exciting. Obviously, Arlene has come in. She's come over from New Zealand. She probably didn't expect the call-ups to be this sudden. But I think she's a very good player. She's come into the Super Series and done very well for the Dragons. So it'll be very exciting for her. And having my fellow 2YM, Sarah Forbes and Kate, is very exciting. So hopefully they do get to make their debut. But look, they've been training really hard. So fingers crossed, we'll wait and see. But yeah, it is a very exciting series for them, and the potential to make their debut is very exciting.
The South Africans, tell us about them.
So they obviously have a few players missing, I think, due to injury, but look, they're obviously a top nation. They did very well in the World Cup. But look, we're going in as underdogs, so I've no doubt that we'll give them a good challenge, and I think we can turn a few wins to our side. So I'm really looking forward to the challenge, and I think on Friday will be great. Like, hopefully down in Pembroke get a good crowd, and fingers crossed the weather holds up. Which
yeah,
I've
it's only five are in as well, so if you fancy a bit of international cricket, 4:30
exactly.
Start. It's 4:30 start, isn't it, on Friday?
4:30 start on Friday, yeah, down in Pembroke.
Down at Pembroke in Dublin. So they've got Friday, Monday and then Wednesday, well, isn't it, for the
T20s? Yeah, the T20s, yeah.
And then you go into a series of 50 over games against them, don't you?
Yes, so they're the first championship games, which is very exciting as well. Obviously, we qualified for that in November. So they're obviously probably the biggest games out of the series to get off on a good foot in that championship. So obviously, we play Pakistan then in November. So it'll be good to get into. Obviously, we've had good preparation in the Super Series for that 50-over format, so fingers crossed we can put in some good performances in that.
Yeah, just to explain to people, the Super Series is a series of games in T20 and 50 overs between three teams. It's rather like the Interprovincial Men's, who've got four now at the moment. So there was two teams last year, now there's three, so there's a bit more competition for places, which is great. But it's not just South Africa you're playing. You've got a heck of a summer. You mentioned it, Pakistan. You've got the two World Cup finalists and the winners, Australia and England, to come. They're certainly up the ante for you, Gabby. So it's time now as the squad to come up to this kind of level, isn't it?
Exactly. And the introduction to the contract, the full-time contract, has been great. It just means more contact time with coaches and, I guess, just more quality of training as well. Some of the girls, like, not having to work and stuff and just kind of fully dedicate their time to cricket. So I'm really looking forward to seeing how we all go in these upcoming series.
How do you think you'll do against the Australians?
Well, we'll put up a good fight, no doubt. They're not used to our conditions, so and it'd be great to play up in Breedy, which is great. Hopefully get some future girls down and kind of, I guess, we haven't really played up there in a few years, so it'll be great to kind of bring a different crowd to our games, which will be great as well.
Are you looking forward to touring Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, and then a trip to the Caribbean for the West Indies?
Exactly, yeah. Traveling around the world.
I'm going.
That's the highlight of it, isn't it, for cricketers? I mean, you get to go to the Far East, and then when it's all done, just come home via the Caribbean. I mean, that's...
Exactly, sure. Stay on a few days after. Why not?
Yeah.
Jamaica, problem, it's not, I've got to say, a problem, but you can get into camps as well, and you can be there for an awful long time as well, so it can play on your mental health too. So it does sound attractive. But once you're in camp and you're there for, you know, 2 months at a time, you've done your training in the morning, what do you do after that? It actually can be quite difficult on the mental well-being of players. We know John Mooney came out a couple of years ago to say that it affected him quite a lot. So that's another thing you've got to do. And, of course, Gabby, you're playing abroad now quite a bit.
Yeah, 100%. And obviously because of COVID as well, it was twice as hard not being able to get out of that kind of hotel environment. Obviously being on tour, you can go out and about previous to COVID, but having COVID, obviously you couldn't really, you found it hard to kind of switch off.
Yeah, spoke in a bubble, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I think they're looking forward to the summer where you can kind of, especially the home series, you can kind of come in and out and it'll be easier to kind of switch off and have some downtime, which kind of we haven't had in the last 2 years touring. So yeah, look, it's very exciting to have a home series, because this time last year we were in a bubble up playing Scotland, so no, I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah. Your dad's Alan Lewis. I know him well, former Irish cricket captain himself. How much of an influence on your career has he had?
Yeah, of course. Always having him at home. He's obviously there for all the knowledge. So yeah, coming to him, it's great to have at home. Any questions I have, and kind of, he doesn't really put himself on me, but just kind of having him there when I need him, which is the most important thing. So yeah, he's been great in my career.
Do you remember him more as Alan Lewis the referee or Alan Lewis the cricket player?
Probably a bit about when I was younger, probably referee, but now more of a cricket player. It was really the odd game, but sure, I hear for the next 3 days after, because he can't bloody walk after it. So
he's also on cricket commentary now these days. So
exactly. So it's more of a sit-down job for that right now, but no more refereeing, I doubt.
Exactly. Okay, so the first match is Friday. We mentioned it's 4:30 in Pembroke in Dublin. It's only a fiver in, so get down and support the girls as well. What's your expectation for that first match? It's obviously, if you win, it sets up a good platform for the next two games. So the expectation levels, what do you think?
Exactly. I think going into kind of series like this, the first game is usually the most, you kind of catch them off guard, I guess. So I am really looking forward to it. We saw when we played Australia a few years ago, the first game was the closest. So I'm really looking forward to it. We obviously do have a relatively new squad, but it'll be great to take the field together. First international game of the summer. So I'm really looking forward to it. And obviously the girls coming in for the first time, it'll be a great series for them to have at home as well. And I'm no doubt on a Friday evening there'll be a great crowd down, so I'm really looking forward to it.
A few years ago in YM, New Zealand came over and basically trounced the Irish women's team. Things have changed since then. You mentioned it, full time contracts for players. Ed Joyce is staying on as coach for the next 3 years as well. So things are pretty stable in Irish women's cricket at the moment. So with that in mind, you now have to go out and perform, don't you?
Yeah, exactly. And as you say, we do have a very youthful squad, which is great for the next few years as well, going forward. And obviously the introduction in those contracts, things won't just change immediately when the contracts come in. It will over time, but we kind of have to trust the process in that. And
yeah,
the girls are working incredibly hard. I can't fault all the efforts that we're putting in. So no doubt that it'll show on the field.
Right. Well, we wish you the very best of luck, Abby Lewis, who's the interim captain now of the Irish women's cricket team. They're on Friday in Pembroke in Dublin at a 4:30 start. It's only a fiver in. Bank holiday Monday and then the following Wednesday. I hope to get down for a game or two myself. Before we wrap things up, we were actually talking at the top of the programme, myself and Ruby, about Lester Piggott and his influence on racing down over the years. But it is, as we mentioned already, Ruby. Ruby, knock knock, who's there? I can see you on the monitor.
Ruby,
you
watched
the tennis here.
They've gone to a tiebreaker, the tennis here. John, I was listening to you. Alcaraz managed to break Verev back, but they're on the tiebreaker.
Okay, Epsom, what are we expecting this week now? Obviously the Derby week.
Yeah, look, and it's obviously a great week and a poignant week as well, John. There's no doubt about that. I mean, it's the Cazoo Lester Piggott Derby, which rightly it should be. Your favourite is Desert Crown, trained by Sir Michael Stout. Look, Sir Michael Stout is such an huge, iconic figure himself, and who spends a lot of time at cricket matches, especially in the West Indies. He's been from Barbados himself. But look, Rixer Kingscote rides him, huge ride for him. He was very, very impressive in the Dante. He was very good. The main Irish challenger is probably Stone Age, or he would appear to be on the betting anyway, John. He's the shortest of Aidan O'Brien's and the likely mount of Ryan Moore. He was good in Leopardstown in the Derby trial.
Charlie Appleby.
Oh, that's a good question. Definitely Stone Age, changing of the guard, Star of India, is it possible as well? You could definitely see him going with three. How many of them are lively runners? Probably only two. Dunica, of course, runs Piz Baldy, who Frankie Dettori rides, Dunica Aidan's son, was a good winner at Leopardstown as well. And, you know, Gavin Ryan rode him on that occasion, but the owners have chosen to go with Frankie Dettori for the Derby. So, look, he's a big runner too. But Charlie Appleby spoke a lot about Nation's Pride. William Buick is down to ride him. They've been having a wonderful season. He won last time out at Newmarket. He's a decent runner. It's a competitive Derby, John. And, look, I know, I suppose in racing terms, winning the Derby probably doesn't have the draw that it used to for stallions going forward, because being a mile and a half, it tends to maybe suggest the horse is a stamina horse more than a speed horse, and therefore Derby winners now have to come back and trip and win over 10 furlongs to maximise their value as potential stallions. But it's still the Epsom Derby, it's still an iconic race, and
it's all geared to breeding, though, isn't it? Really, in the end of the day, it's all geared to breeding.
It is, but unfortunately,
especially that level, of course.
It is, but then popularity, John, and value outweighs what can be good for the sport. And if you keep breeding back shorter in speed, you end up with less horses who can stay a mile and a half. And ultimately, you will end up with horses that don't actually stay a mile and a quarter. And you'll end up like Australia, breeding sprinter after sprinter and having to import staying horses. So, you know, kind of commerciality has to come into everything, but definitely for the betterment of the sport, the longer distance horses need to be catered for and looked after, because
but Joe Public looking in at that, Joe Public looking in on that, or, you know, those who set up camp at the Epsom Downs don't really know or don't really care about that. I mean, it's all about the day out and the festival as well. I mean, obviously the industry are more interested in the ins and outs of that, aren't they?
No, of course they are. I mean, when you go to Epsom, it's an incredible day out. I've been fortunate enough to have been there a couple of times myself, and to watch the infield filled with people, and they can never gauge how many are there. They're usually going by the estimate of the police as to how many people they think are actually on the infield in Epsom. Huge crowds. Yeah, I mean, it just fills up. But look, obviously this year was supposed to be extra special. It's obviously a 3-day bank holiday weekend in the UK for the Queen's Jubilee. She was due to go to Epsom. She's not going now. So that'll be a bit of a loss for them. You know, the Queen is a huge draw in the UK and she's a massive fan of racing. So that is a loss for Epsom.
Yeah. Who do you think is going to win the Derby then? Stout is obviously the favourite.
He has the favourite. I think Nation's Pride could win. I think Charlie Appleby, William Buick, they've won all the Guineas. They're on a hot run. I think it'll be the Godolphin Blue rather than the Navy Blue of Ballydoyle.
And are you working the weekend yourself? What's the
No, John, I am going with my daughter to the UK, who is riding on an Irish tetrathlon team. So that's where I will be for the weekend, watching her swim
and
run.
Tetrathlon. What's
tetrathlon? So she'll shoot, swim, ride and run. So
shoot,
she will.
Swim, ride and run. Okay.
Shoot, swim, ride and run herself, and 38 others representing Ireland.
Okay, cool. Where's that on?
It's on in Morton Morell, just south of Warwick.
Okay.
near Stratford. I was trying to tell her we'd go to Stratford and she could learn a bit of Shakespeare and go to Maud Gonne's cottage for a cup of tea, but no, my kids weren't having that chance.
Not at all. Anyway, we'll have Jane Mangan on Thursday's Game On to get her thoughts on Epsom. Ruby, thanks for being there tonight. I'm John Kenny. Enjoy the last couple of days. Thanks to Ronan Lawler, who produced today's programme, and I'll talk to you around the block sometime. Actually, I'm off to Armenia.
Do you know what, John? Just could go to a fifth set yet. Alcaraz is just about getting there.
You go off and enjoy. There's a 2FM party on tonight. That's where I'm going. Good luck.
Enjoy.
RTE. 2FM. Game On. On 2FM. With Green Farm. Green Farm's new added benefits range is enriched with all your B vitamins, which are essential for your health and well-being. Available in store now.